King of Purcell, Handel, Parry or Britain, you'd be mistaken. On the Early Music Show this Jubilee weekend, we're shining a light on the people who've shaped royal music, from the Huguenot lutenist Nicholas Lanier to the incumbent Judith Weir.
It's been a long time since there's been an actual job description. It's an extremely varied and extremely vague role.
Discover more about the master of the Queen's music with me, Hannah French, on the Early Music Show this afternoon at 2 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the author and former lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret, Anne Glenconner.
At 11:15 a.m. on the 2nd of June, 1953, Lady Anne Cook, the eldest daughter of the 5th Earl of Leicester, stood at the door of Westminster Abbey, dressed in a gorgeous embroidered white satin gown. She was 20, one of 6 maids of honour, about to pick up the Queen's 21-foot-long velvet train and follow her up the aisle at the start of the coronation. What followed that momentous day for Lady Anne Cook, who became Lady Glenconner, was a life of continued service to the royal family, as well as running enormous houses, having 5 children, hosting glamorous parties and travelling the world. But her life story is also shot through with terrible family tragedy. Then, at the age of 87, she published her best-selling memoir, Lady in Waiting, followed by 2 novels. Her new book, Whatever Next, will be published in the autumn. And I want to talk to you about your extraordinary life and your love of music. But first, I must hear about the coronation. What are your overwhelming memories of the days leading up to it?
Well, the days leading up to it was so exciting because we went regularly to be tutored by the Duke of Norfolk, who arranged the Queen's father's coronation before the war. And the Queen had actually been there as a child, but I'm sure she had taken in quite a lot because, I mean, she was so fantastically calm about the whole thing.
And, of course, it wasn't all glamour because I think you spent the night before the coronation sleeping on the floor of your uncle's flat.
Yes, my mother couldn't find anywhere to stay because London was packed. Every bed was taken. And we had this lovely Uncle Jack, great Uncle Jack Cook, who had a very small flat, 1 bedroom. Anyway, he said, would you like that? And so my mother said, well, very kind Jack, we'd love that. But as a result, I slept on a mattress on the floor. But I remember in the morning it was raining and it wasn't very bright, and our dresses were hanging up on the wardrobe. And mine was, I thought, the most beautiful dress in the world, because having been brought up in the war, coupons, we'd had no clothes at all. And my mother's dress was hanging up with us, and the dawn came, because I didn't sleep very much that night. And the dawn came and lit up our 2 dresses. And I thought, later on, I'll be wearing that.
Well, we're going to hear the music played immediately before you set off up the aisle of Westminster Abbey behind the Queen. This is a wonderfully English piece of music, but it immediately conjures up a great emotional moment, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, I've chosen this as my first bit because I suppose the coronation was the most marvellous day of my life. The great moment was when we were waiting for her. We were standing at the door and suddenly we could hear her coming. We could hear this roar, and round the corner came the golden coach, and it drew up. The 2 pages opened the door, and I think she was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. She had this fantastic embroidered dress covered in diamonds, wonderful tiara, and, of course, her magical smile. And we then helped her out of the coach, took the train, and she came into the Abbey, and the train then rippled back from her, and we were standing there. She had her back to us, and the train came over our hands, and we waited. And then she just turned round and she said, "Ready, girls?" And then, of course, off we went.
Nimrod from Elgar's Enigma Variations with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Adrian Bolt, who led the orchestra in that music at the Queen's coronation. And, Glenconner, you write in your book about your friendship since early childhood with the Queen and Princess Margaret. What were they like as children?
Well, of course, we did see them quite a lot because I was brought up at Holcombe and it's very near Sandringham, so they came over a lot. And I think I was three, I suppose, when I really remember them both. And, of course, I fell instantly in love with Princess Margaret because I could see, yeah, she's quite naughty and I was quite naughty too. And we just had the best possible time. The Queen, of course, was 6 years older than me and more serious. She always took great trouble in looking after Princess Margaret. She always had an eye out for her. We used to also go down on Holcombe Beach and build sandcastles and holes, which we hoped people would fall into. I don't think anybody did. But Princess Margaret and I got on very, very well. She was very inventive, Princess Margaret, and always thought of lovely things, rather naughty things to do. And, of course, you know, she was a friend for the whole of my life, really.
As one of her closest friends, you became a lady-in-waiting for more than 30 years. What are the duties of a lady-in-waiting? What does she have to do?
We were given certain charities that Princess Margaret was a patron of, and we used to deal with the charity. We used to write quite a lot of letters, thank you letters, and then we went with her, really as a companion. Our job was to see that the whole, if she was going to visit a hospital or a factory or something like that, the whole visit went smoothly. And we had to find out sort of things, basic things like where the lavatory was. Yes.
But, and that there was time to go to it.
Yeah, and then I used to have to stand outside the door while she's in the lavatory to stop anybody going in. So one sort of arranged her life to make it as comfortable as possible for her.
You describe Princess Margaret as funny and very kind. Why did she gain a reputation for being a bit abrupt sometimes?
Well, I think Princess Margaret didn't stand fools gladly. And she liked to know exactly what she was doing in advance. And what she really disliked was suddenly somebody would say, oh, ma'am, would you do this or that, you know, and she hadn't been told. I mean, I found her very easy. She came and stayed with me regularly in Norfolk. And she's wonderful. She bought her Marigot gloves, and she slightly Marie Antoinette, but she had absolutely loved cleaning my car, so I was absolutely thrilled. Mammy as well. And I'd like, and the other thing she did was she did all my fires, the wood fires, because she said, well, Anne, I was a girl guide, you weren't. I know exactly how to do the fire. So I said, well, that's great, carry on.
You clearly found a very good level of, let me put it this way, of friendship with the right degree of deference.
Yes, I mean, I would no more dreamt of calling her Margaret. It was always ma'am, or sometimes Princess Margaret. I would have felt very uncomfortable. I was brought up, I mean, all my family, my father was a query to the Duke of York, my mother was lady-in-waiting to the Queen, my aunt was lady-in-waiting to Queen Elizabeth, Uncle Jack was lord-in-waiting to Queen Mary.
More music now from Elgar, this time his Dream of Gerontius, which I think reminds you of another very important musical influence in your life, your grandfather, the 4th Earl of Leicester.
Absolutely. I love my grandfather. My grandfather had this gramophone in the Long Gallery at Holcombe. And I remember, because I was quite young, I suppose, but dancing, not very elegantly, I don't think. But anyway, my grandfather was very sweet and always said, Anne, you're dancing beautifully, and as I sort of thumped around. But one of the pieces of music that he really loved was The Dream of Gerontius. And he had it at his funeral. And my mother had it at hers. And I think probably I will have it at mine. There's a rather funny story about it, which perhaps I shouldn't really tell you, but I am going to. Because when Princess Margaret, you know, had done the whole of her funeral, she'd chosen all the prayers, the hymns and everything. And she said to me, "Oh, Anne, what are you going to have at your funeral?" So I said, "Well, I'm going to have this piece from The Dream of Gerontius." And she said, "You can't possibly have that." So I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Well, it was written by a Roman Catholic." And, of course, the thing about it, people often say Catholic, and she would always say, "Not, we're all Catholic, Roman Catholic."
Yes. Well, of course, the words are Cardinal Newman, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely.
That's the problem.
That's the problem. But anyway, I'm going to take absolutely no notice of what Princess Margaret told me.
On this occasion.
On this occasion.
"Softly and gently, dearly ransomed soul, Sarah Connolly with The Angel's Farewell from Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius." We heard Andrew Davis conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. Anne Glenconrig, being a girl, you couldn't inherit the family title or Holcombe. And because you had two younger sisters, everything went to a distant cousin. Were you just brought up to think of primogeniture as being a natural thing, or did you resent it?
I knew when I was growing up that I was a terrible disappointment because I was a girl, because we just knew how much my father minded about it. And I did. I remember saying to him once, which in those days was quite unusual, I said, "Shall I have a sex change? Would that help?" And he said, "No, he didn't think it would help, actually." But I was absolutely prepared to have it, because nowadays it might be more easy. It might be easier.
Yes.
I don't know.
During the war, your parents were abroad with the army and you didn't see them for 3 years. So your mum had a governess who'd been recommended to her. But what she did to you rather beggars belief, doesn't it?
She was unbelievable. I mean, I think the real difficulty was that I suppose my mother had seen her. I don't even know whether she'd even seen her. But at the age of 7, I thought my mother must know what she was doing to me, that she must approve. And I think that was the most difficult thing of all, thinking that my mother had engaged her in order to do these things to me.
What form did the ill treatment take?
I mean, one of the terrifying things about Miss Bonner, it didn't matter how good I was during the day, always at night she would say that I'd done something wrong. And then she'd get my hands and she had some rags, I remember, white rags, and she would tie my hands to the top of the bed all night, which was agony. And now, even now, I sometimes wake up with my hands above my head. And it lasted, I suppose, a year.
It's a form of torture, really.
It was. But interestingly, when I tried to talk to my mother about it when she came back from Egypt, all she said to me, "Oh, darling, things like that happened in the war."
You want to hear Joan Sutherland singing "I Dreamt I Dwelt in Marble Halls" to remind you of growing up in marble halls at Holcombe.
I mean, I just couldn't resist it because my grandfather used to play it as a joke, really, and I used to dance. And, of course, Holcombe has got the most beautiful marble hall, I think, in Great Britain. I may get up now and whirl around.
Reach us to the ground, the cross, the cross, the cross.
Joan Sutherland with I Dreamt I Dwelt in Marble Halls from the second act of Michael Balfe's 1843 opera The Bohemian Girl. Richard Bonning conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Aaron Glenconner, when you were in your late teens, you, your sister Carey and your mother Elizabeth set up the Holcombe Pottery, which became pretty successful. And you were in charge of sales, a travelling sales rep, an unusual job for the daughter of an earl, but in fact, it was a job you really took to. What did your fellow travelling salesmen make of you?
Well, I think they were a bit surprised because I was the only woman. They were all men to begin with. And I was very young and I suppose quite pretty in those days. And they were, I mean, amazed and very deferential and leapt up to carry my very heavy suitcase of pottery and put it in the car. But actually, I really enjoyed doing that because I wasn't very good at pottery. I wasn't very artistic. My job there had been fettling and sponging, which was extremely boring. And it really opened up my life. And I met completely different people, obviously, that I normally wouldn't have met. And that, from that moment, took me to sell pottery in America. And, of course, it was there, while I was there, that the telegram arrived from my mother saying, come back, Anne. The Queen has asked you to be a maid of honour at the coronation. And I hadn't done very well with selling the pottery. But I had two sort of fairly nice Toby jugs of the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh. And, of course, wow, the whole lot went when I arrived back with a full order book.
The life of a travelling sales rep was in huge contrast to your magnificent coming-out dance at Holcombe in June 1950. The idea of the season was to find a husband, wasn't it? And what was your parents' idea of a perfect husband?
My father wanted me to marry somebody in the Scots Guards, to begin with, and somebody of his own age, he thought, more suitable. And there was a very nice man called the Earl of Stair. We had absolutely nothing in common whatsoever. And he kept on saying, well, darling, you know, couldn't you see yourself? John Stair's got the most beautiful castle in Scotland, wonderful fishing, and as for the shooting. And I said, Dad, OK, you've got it all at home. I'm not going to marry him just because you can go and shoot with him. And so my father was all disappointed and said, well, that's very disappointing. What about his brother, Colin Dalrymple? So I had to go out with him a bit. Again, absolutely no sparks.
More opera now. Britain's Billy Budd, the aria when Billy's preparing for execution. Opera really became your great musical passion, didn't it?
It did. My grandfather started off at Holcombe. And then, of course, my first boyfriend, being Nigel Douglas, a singer, cemented it because he used to take me to all the operas. Also, he was singing and he was a great friend of Benjamin Britten. And because Holcombe is quite near Suffolk, we used to go down there a lot.
Here, baby Danska, old friend, that's kind. That's kind. Give me a biscuit too. I feel better, but you shouldn't have risked coming to see me. You'll get into trouble.
First trouble, the whole ship's trouble, and upside down.
What for?
Some reckon to rescue you. Billy boy, how they hated the Jamie legs. They swear you shan't swing.
I'll swing and they'll swing. I'll swing and they'll swing. Tell them that and stop them. Tell them that and stop them. Christ, I feel better. Done me a lot of good, a drink, and seeing a friend. Stop me from thinking on what's no use and dreaming what needn't be dreamt and woken me up to face what must be, what must be.
Mm-hmm.
what's the day to be?
A fair
day. We'd have caught that frenzy on a fair day. Oh, that cursed mist, that cursed mist. Maybe you'll still catch up. Better be going now.
Goodbye, baby.
Can't shake hands. Chaplain's been here before you. Kind and good his story of the good boy Hal and gone to glory. For the likes of me, the likes of me. But I had to strike down that Jemmy Lanes. It's fate, and Captain Vere has had to strike me down. Fate, we're both in sore trouble, him and me, with great need for strength, and my troubles ending, so I can't help him long. His starry beard, God bless him, and the clouds darker than night for us both. Dancer of the indomitable, help him, all of you. Dancer, goodbye, goodbye.
Thomas Hampson as Billy Budd in music from Benjamin Britten's opera, with Kent Nagano conducting the Halle Orchestra. And you can find details of all the music chosen by my guest today, Leanne Glenconner, if you visit the Private Passions webpage. And if you search in BBC Sounds, you can find hundreds of previous editions of the programme, which you can download and enjoy wherever and whenever you wish. And in 1955, we've all glossed over this, you married Colin Tennant, which you later...
I can't gloss over marrying Colin Tennant.
later Lord Glenconner. And together, you turned Moustique in the Grenadines into a sort of celebrity paradise, with Princess Margaret, Mick Jagger rubbing shoulders in the beach bar. In your book, you're keen to emphasise Colin's many good points. He was charismatic, he made you laugh, and you had lots of adventures together, but he could be dreadful, couldn't he?
Yes, he could be absolutely impossible, and you never knew when it was going to happen. That was the trouble.
These temper tantrums.
Terrible tantrums. Well, in my book, Ladies in Waiting, probably people know, you know, when he was dragged off the aeroplane.
He was banned from some airlines.
And Lord King wrote to and said he's banned from BA. Luckily, Virgin was getting going, so he was able to use another airline.
And he had a rather unconventional way of entertaining you during the first night of your honeymoon in Paris.
Why he thought that was a good idea, I do not know. And I remember being so thrilled because I thought I was going to the Ritz for dinner. And in those days, you had a trousseau. And I put on my best dress and, yeah, I remember, and frightfully excited, got into the taxi. And I had a sort of awful feeling because I sort of vaguely knew which way the Ritz was. And I said, where are we going, Colin? All he said was, it's a surprise, just wait and see. And, of course, eventually the taxi drew up at this really ghastly sort of brothel, actually, I suppose it was. And we were led upstairs where there were these two wing-back chairs. I remember they were made of red velvet. And then on the bed in front of us were these two people making love. And I just shut my eyes. I just, absolutely, the noise and smell and the whole thing. I didn't dare look at Colin to see what he was doing. And they kept on saying, would you like to join in? And I said, well, I was very polite in those days. It was frightfully kind of you, but no, thank you. Anyway, I got through that one.
Very early in your marriage, you fled to your mother, but she sent you straight back, didn't she?
Well, she did. I think she was right, because, you know, in those days you were brought up tougher, and I was expecting Charlie, and she said, you married him, you go straight back. So I did for 56 years, Polly.
But you probably wouldn't say to a daughter or granddaughter, stay in a marriage where that was going
well,
on.
Well, nowadays, no. I mean, but it didn't occur when I was young.
Well, actually, the piece we're going to hear next from Verdi's Nabucco, I'm afraid, does take you back to a rather bad moment.
Well, Colin was frightfully kind because he didn't really enjoy opera, but he decided to take me on an opera tour in Italy, and it was wonderful. He didn't come to all the operas, but anyway, on this occasion in Verona, huge open-air theatre, and he had this valet, this man that looked after him, who wasn't a bit interested in opera, and there's some huge football match going on. So Kent went off to watch, to listen to the football. Anyway, the chorus of Hebrew Slaves started, and I could see Colin sort of shifting about, and he suddenly started to scream and shout and cry and say, oh, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. Where's Kent? I want him to come and listen. And I said, well, he can't. He's not interested, I said. I said, I'm here, but I wasn't enough. And anyway, everybody started to look round. And so I took the rug and I just put it over his head like a parrot in a cage. We shut him up. Anyway, it ended and the conductor turned to the audience and said, under the circumstances, I think we better have this again. So shame.
the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from the third act of Verdi's Nabucco, with Riccardo Muti conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra and the Ambrosian Opera Chorus. And Glenconner, in the 1980s, your really quite glamorous life was completely blown apart by unimaginable family tragedy. Your eldest son, Charlie, was struggling with a heroin addiction, the effects of which ultimately killed him. And in 1986, your second son, Henry, was diagnosed with HIV and quickly became fatally ill with AIDS. And then in 1987, your third child, Christopher, had a devastating motorbike accident while on his gap year, which almost killed him. This must have almost killed you, actually, this series of events.
Yes, I often think I don't know how I actually got through it. The only sort of thing about something like this happening in one's life, that one feels that nothing ever again could be as bad. Well, that's what I hope, anyway. I've always had a faith, but it was rather sort of, you know, going to church every Sunday and, you know, saying one's prayers. And it wasn't actually until this happened that I really found my faith.
Christopher was in a coma for months and doctors were quite close on giving up on him, weren't they? But you didn't give up.
I had a very serious conversation with God, and I said, look, I know you're going to take two of my sons. You're not going to take Christopher, and you've got to help me. And this is what happened. I became energized, and I was able then to go on coping. Two of my sons then died. Christopher was in a coma for 5 months. He couldn't speak for a year. I looked after him for 5 years. And I was able to do it.
And how is he now?
Well, Christopher has been married twice. He had two very clever daughters, and he's never been able to work. I mean, he's still very badly disabled. But he's never complained. He's always cheerful. He has, in the past, used to help other people who were head injured. And when I was looking after, during that time, I used to play a lot of music because it's the one thing that really relaxed me. And I don't know, it gave me sort of hope, actually. Mm. And this Requiem was one of them, one of the things I listened to a lot.
Oh,
The Dies Irae from Verdi's Requiem, with David Parry conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra and Choir and the London Chorus. It did occur to me that that is possibly the most operatic of all requiems, so it combines two of your loves, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Christopher was sort of plugged into it at one point. I thought it might help him in his coma, which I think it did, actually.
Got him going.
It got him going.
Yes. Well, from opera to operetta, because we've got music for your father now, who was a big fan, wasn't he, of Gilbert and Sullivan. He was a slightly distant figure in your childhood.
He was. I mean, I partly chose this because it was conducted by Malcolm Sargent. And Malcolm Sargent was a great family friend. My mother liked him very much. And my father was distant, but the only time, once a year, he thought he should do something with me. And so operetta, he's mad about the Gypsy Baron and those sort of operas. And Gilbert and Sullivan, he really loved it. And it was rather a treat because, you know, he used to take me on my own and I sort of dressed up and went. And it was a sort of lovely occasion that my father was doing something with me, because on the whole, he didn't. He wasn't, you know, because I wasn't a boy, I suppose.
I will tell you what I am. I'm a genuine philanthropist. All other kinds are sham. It's little fault of temper and it's social defect. In my erring fellow creatures, I endeavor to correct. To all their little weaknesses, I open people's eyes. And little plans to snub the self-sufficient I devise. I love my fellow creatures. I do all the good I can. Yet everybody says I'm such a disagreeable man. And I can't think why. Compliments inflated, I've a withering reply. And vanity, I always do my best to mortify. A charitable action I can skillfully dissect. And interested motives I'm delighted to detect. I know everybody's income and what everybody earns. And I carefully compare it with the income tax returns. But to benefit humanity, however much I plan, yet everybody says I'm such a disagreeable man. And I can't think why. I'm sure I'm no ascetic, I'm as pleasant as can be. You'll always find me ready with a crushing repartee. I've an irritating chuckle, I've a celebrated sneer, I've an entertaining snigger, I've a fascinating leer. To everybody's prejudice, I know a thing or two. I can tell a woman's age in half a minute, and I do. But although I try to make myself as pleasant as I can, yet everybody says I am a disagreeable man, and I can't think why.
John Reed explaining his misanthropy in that aria from the first act of Princess Ida by Gilbert and Sullivan. Malcolm Sargent conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and the Doyle Carte Opera Chorus in that 1965 recording. And the final twist in the story of your marriage to Colin was that when he died in 2010, he left everything to his former servant, Kent. That must have tested you to the very limit.
I think that was a worse thing, in a way. I minded so much for the children. I mean, and the children weren't mentioned at all. And I mean, I've been looking after Colin because he had cancer, been with him. He'd made a new will, which made me very nervous. And this lawyer came forward with one piece of paper. And on it, it said, I leave everything to Kent Adoni. And I trust he will carry out my wishes towards the family. And so when I went to Kent, I said, I do hope, Kent, who I was very friendly with, I'd held his hand during the funeral, and he sort of cried all over me. And he just said then, I don't know what you mean. So I knew that was it. And in a way, It did. Perhaps it did me quite a lot of good, because I wouldn't have written my book if it hadn't been for that. I felt I must try and make a bit of money for the children, and I was able to.
Was it not possible to challenge that?
Yes, my grandson did, because he's now Lord Glenconner. And in the end, after 7 long years, he got some of the land back.
Yeah.
So at least he got something.
Yes. We're going to end the programme on a celebratory note, because in July you will turn 90.
Well, I know. I cannot... Well, my cousin, Tom Lester, very kindly said I can have my birthday lunch at Holcombe. So I'm absolutely thrilled. And I'm going to sort of do it up, because I've been christened there. I had my coming out, wonderful coming out dance there with Princess Margaret. The King and Queen came with white tie and medals. And I was married there, and I'll be buried there. And so I'm having, it was really exciting. I'm doing up the Long Gallery as it was when I had my coming out dance a long time ago now. Now I'm really looking forward to that.
And did you used to enjoy not only sailing, but doing Norfolk things like collecting samphire on the marsh?
Absolutely. Samphire, well, that suddenly, because nobody knew about samphire when I was young, we ate it. But now it's in the smartest restaurants, costs a fortune for one tiny little bit. And, of course, one of the things that has given me more pleasure in my life, I suppose, than anything else, is sailing. And I learnt to sail when I was 5 at Burnham Overysdale, and I gave up when I was 80 because I really felt I couldn't pull my boat in. And I ended up with a Mirror, which is a dear little boat with a red sail. And so I thought I must have something to do with sailing to end it. And also, because I'm getting very old now, and I spend my whole time going to other people's funerals. And I make a little list about what I would like in my... I've got such a big list, I'll have to cut it down. But I had thought at one point, my children were so horrified, that I could be put into a boat and set on fire and be sent out to sea.
Ah, yes. Well, of course.
But I'm not quite sure if you're allowed to do that nowadays.
Well, how lovely to finish then with Sailing By, which of course is used as to close the evening on Radio 4. So it only remains for me and Glenconner. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vernon Hanley conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra in Sailing by Ronald Benge. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Anne Glenconner. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. You can find all the details for all of today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. The programme returns next Sunday at noon when Michael's guest will be the children's author and creator of Horrid Henry, Francesca Simon. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Vigialis. More than 10,000 people are preparing to stage a pageant in the streets around Buckingham Palace as part of the last day of celebrations for the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The parade will depict key moments from each decade of the monarch's 70-year reign. Ed Sheeran, Gary Lineker and Basil Brush are among the celebrities scheduled to take part, but it's not yet known whether the Queen herself will make an appearance on the palace balcony. Prince Charles and the Duchess of Cornwall have been visiting the Oval Cricket Ground in London to take part in one of thousands of Jubilee lunch events happening across the UK. At a concert outside Buckingham Palace last night, Prince Charles paid tribute to his mother, saying she laughs and cries with us all. EasyJet says it's cancelled around 80 flights today, blaming what it called a challenging operating environment. The airline hasn't specified the destination of the flights or whether they all arrived or departed the UK. Earlier, the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, told the BBC he would work with the aviation industry to make sure disruption doesn't continue into the summer. He said the process for rearranging bookings and getting refunds was too complicated. At least two Ukrainian cities, including the capital Kyiv, have been targeted by Russian missile strikes as fighting continues in the east of the country. Moscow's defense ministry said the attacks destroyed tanks and other armored vehicles given to Ukraine by some European countries. Further east, the mayor of Kramatorsk says two factories were hit by missiles. In Severodonetsk, the main target of Russia's current ground offensive, the regional governor says Ukrainian forces have retaken some ground and now control about half the town. The details haven't been verified independently. COVID restrictions in the Chinese capital Beijing are to be gradually lifted, allowing people to go back to work and eat in restaurants from Monday. Most public transport will be reopened at the same time. England's new men's test cricket captain Ben Stokes and head coach Brendan McCullum have led the team to victory in their first match in charge. They beat New Zealand by 5 wickets at Lord's. Finally, the weather. Northern Ireland and Scotland will be mostly sunny and dry, but cloud will develop in southern Scotland, cloudier in England and Wales, with spells of heavy and thundery rain in places. Top temperatures reaching 17 Celsius in London, 16 in Cardiff and 15 in Edinburgh and Belfast. That's the BBC News and weather at 1:30 past 1.
There've been 21 masters of the King's or Queen's music over the nearly 400-year existence of the role. But if you were thinking of Purcell, Handel, Parry or Britten, you'd be mistaken. On the Early Music Show this Jubilee weekend, we're shining a light on the people who've shaped royal music, from the Huguenot lutenist Nicholas Lanier to the incumbent Judith Weir.
It's been a long time since there's been an actual job description.